From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, lots of drama for a sitcom. ABC suddenly cancels its hit series, Roseanne, after its star sends out a racist tweet. Then actress Shailene Woodley talks about her new movie, Adrift, the HBO series Big Little Lies, and how she decides whether to take on a new project.
I feel like at this point, and this is not just in my career, this is just in life, I feel like I have a no-jerk policy.
And what's next for the Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown Los Angeles as it searches for a new leader? All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. This morning, Roseanne Barr sent out a racist tweet about former Obama administration official Valerie Jarrett, along with false conspiracy theories about Chelsea Clinton and financier and activist George Soros. Wanda Sykes, a consulting producer on Roseanne, was among the many who reacted strongly to Barr's comments, stating that she would not be returning to the show. As it quickly turned out, no one will be returning to the show. In a move that was staggering in both its speed and its scope, ABC canceled Roseanne, which was the highest-rated scripted series on all of television last season. To discuss the implications of this cancellation, I called up Ted Johnson. He's a senior editor for Variety, and I asked him if he was shocked that ABC decided to pull the plug.
I actually am. I thought that they would try to find a way to hold on to this show. After all, it's one of the breakout hits of the season. It had been renewed. But when you look at Disney corporate, you think, well, this is kind of the way that corporations respond now when one of their personalities makes a racist comment or a comment that enough people believe to be racially tinged, is to kind of nip it in the bud.
This isn't the first time that Roseanne has made incredibly offensive comments on Twitter. In March, she tried linking Hillary Clinton to a child sex trafficking conspiracy. Had her behavior started to affect the show's ratings? And was this a ticking time bomb in some ways?
Probably was a ticking time bomb. And I'm not so sure it started affecting the show's ratings. That's just a hard thing to actually prove. But I think from a PR perspective, I think ABC was buying into something that was bound to explode somewhere down the line, just given Roseanne's history of making these types of remarks.
Just a couple of weeks ago, ABC Entertainment President Channing Dungey said that the show would, quote, steer away from politics and toward family, unquote. And this morning, before ABC canceled the show, Sarah Gilbert, one of the show's original cast members and an executive producer, issued a statement asking audiences to try to separate Roseanne's behavior from the show's message. It's part of the problem that ABC faced here, that there is no separation that people can really understand between Roseanne the person and Roseanne the character.
That's one of the problems, is that her character on the show is so similar to Roseanne the person. And she went into this not trying to disguise the fact that she was a Trump supporter. She would give interviews and she would talk. And I think that really did probably help the show stand out from the pack. I mean, other sitcoms, which tend to be more from the point of view of young urban professionals, as opposed to Roseanne, which was a genuine working class family sitcom.
One of the issues for Disney, the parent company of ABC, is that so much of what is said, even things that are reprehensible, are magnified on social media. ESPN earlier had suspended Jemele Hill when she had used Twitter to urge a boycott of the Dallas Cowboys. Is this part of the world in which any media company now operates, that if people make comments on social media that any segment of the nation finds offensive, that there's going to be a backlash and a kind of a cyclone of reaction that may put a company like Disney in an untenable place?
It's kind of the culture that we live in where everything happens quicker now. I think back to the 1980s, and I remember there was a figure on CBS Sports. His name was Jimmy the Greek, and he did this interview where he just talked too much, and he started talking about the differences between African-American players and white players, and a lot of people saw what he said as racist. And the controversy over this lasted for a couple of days before CBS finally decided to, you know, just sever ties and to fire him. Now this all unfolded in a matter of just a couple of hours.
So where does this leave ABC? Obviously, they have a big hole to fill, even if they had no other choice but to cancel Roseanne.
I think what really worked in Roseanne is it dealt with this whole political division, cultural division, even racial division, in a very frank way. It wasn't just a pro-Trump show. It was a show that actually presented these multiple points of view. The problem they had, though, is in signing on Roseanne, you also have to accept that you're dealing with very controversial figure with very controversial points of view.
Even if there was a lot of negative reaction to Roseanne's racist comments, there was also a lot of support for Roseanne from commentators on right-wing news sites like Breitbart. Many of the commentators on Breitbart right now are calling for a boycott of ABC. Was that part of the audience for Roseanne, conservatives who didn't feel the lot of Hollywood storytelling was speaking to them?
I believe it was, but it's hard to make the case that it was the overwhelming audience, especially after that first episode. There was a breakdown of where it did well and what markets it did well, and it certainly showed that there were middle of the country cities that got a spike from her viewership. But you also saw some pretty good viewership in major cities. So I don't think you could definitively say Roseanne was the show for Trump America.
You have covered Hollywood a fair number of years. Can you think in recent memory of somebody who rose as fast as Roseanne did in the last year and fell as fast as she did this morning?
No, I can't. In that regard, it's really a unique situation. But when you view it from the prism of how do corporations respond right now, when someone they're associated with, someone they're in business with, makes a remark like that, it tends to be on the favor of get rid of it as quickly as you can. Otherwise, you run the risk of it tarnishing your own reputation and your own brand.
Ted Johnson is a senior editor at Variety who specializes in the intersection of politics and entertainment. Ted, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And a couple more related notes. Roseanne Barr has been dropped as a client by her talent agents, ICM, and one of the show's cast members and executive producers, Sarah Gilbert, tweeted this statement, quote, "Roseanne's recent comments about Valerie Jarrett and so much more are abhorrent and do not reflect the beliefs of our cast and crew or anyone associated with our show," unquote.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
The movie Adrift opens this week. It's a true story that stars Shailene Woodley as Tammy Oldham, a woman who set sail with her fiancé on what was supposed to be a long but relatively safe voyage from Tahiti to San Diego in 1983. But their boat was hit by a catastrophic storm, leaving it crippled without a radio or navigation in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Woodley came by the Frame Studios fresh off of shooting season 2 of Big Little Lies. That's the HBO show produced by and starring Reese Witherspoon, along with Nicole Kidman, Zoe Kravitz, and Laura Dern. We'll talk about that in a bit, but first we begin with what drew Woodley to the story of Tammy Oldham, as told in her memoir, Adrift, a true story of love, loss, and survival at sea.
I fell in love with this because it's a love story, and I'm such a sucker for love. At the end of the day, you know, when we're all in our deathbeds, I feel like love is always what we reflect on, and relationships, and you know, that's not limited to partnerships, but relationships in general. And it takes a very specific person to be a sailor and to be willing to surrender all of the comforts of life, to be out on the ocean where it's cold, it's unpredictable, you're not sleeping a lot, you're eating canned tuna every day. But there's a certain affirmation or a soul affirmation that sailors talk about, and that's what brought these two people together. So, yes, it is a movie about survival, and it's a movie about strength and human will and desire to survive, but it's really about the love that these two people shared and how that love aided survival.
There was footage that was shown to movie theater owners a couple weeks ago at CinemaCon, the theater owners convention in Las Vegas. And I was there and I saw some footage and I saw a lot of presentations from a lot of companies. And there were two other women at least who came up, Michelle Williams for her film Venom and Jennifer Garner for her film Peppermint. And they both said they were doing action superhero stories because they felt finally these weren't damsel in distress stories, that it wasn't about a woman who needed some guy to rescue her, and that they had been resistant to doing these kinds of films because that was the stereotype, that you were always the woman who needed some guy to come save you. And I think what's interesting about Adrift is it really fits into that idea. This is a woman who doesn't need somebody to save her. She's going to do her own saving.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, this is a true story, and it happened in the 80s where, you know, perhaps Hollywood wasn't, they could have made this movie in the 80s.
Perhaps they could have
made this movie in the 90s. They could have made this movie in the early 2000s. But, you know, this is the day and age where things are shifting, to Michelle and Jennifer's point. And I think it's beautiful and dynamic that stereotype is, you know, the paradigm is shifting surrounding stereotypes, specifically with women. But that doesn't mean that these stories have never existed. And it doesn't mean that they haven't been itching to be told. And Tammy, I've been very fortunate to get to know over the last couple years. And she said she's been waiting 34 years to be able to share this with people because of the amount of inspiration she's seen people receive from simply her personal interactions, sharing her experience.
And the thing that you probably know from talking to her is that nobody would publish the book, that
right.
She had to publish
she's
it herself because nobody was interested in mm-hmm. a story about a woman surviving at sea.
Yeah, she self-published this book. First she wrote it, then she had to self-publish it. And then the reason why it got wider distribution is because an amazing lit agent read the book and was completely taken aback by it and enamored with it and contacted Tammy and asked her if she was able to publish it.
This is a movie that looks as if you are, as an audience member, on the boat, that you are really with these characters as they're going through this experience. What does that do for you as an actor when you are in a physical place or doing something physical as a character? How does that affect performance?
Yeah, I mean, this movie is so different from any other experience simply because we did film about 90% of it on the, you mentioned, you know, it feels like as an audience member that you're on the ocean. And I think that's attributed to the fact that we did film 90% of the film on the ocean. So it puts you in a natural state of awareness. There's really no pretending or pretense. When you have a green screen, when you're working on a soundstage, there is an element of having to trick yourself into feeling the wind in your hair and trick yourself into feeling the bite of the salt constantly crusting away at your skin. But when you're fortunate enough to work in an environment like we were able to, the character, I feel like, just naturally takes over you. There's not much pretending, faking, or even acting that goes into it at all. And the beautiful thing about working in nature like that is every scene is completely different, because one scene you might have a bead of sweat dripping down your face from the sun and you have to react to that, and then the next scene you might have a fish jump next to the boat and you have to react to that. And it really allows for an element of surprise and improvisation that you don't get in a lot of other situations.
We're talking with Shailene Woodley. Her new movie is called Adrift. Would you say that the criteria that you have for what you say yes to evolves? And how does it evolve? How does it change in terms of things you not only say yes to, but also those things you don't want to be a part of?
I feel like at this point, and this is not just in my career, this is just in life, I feel like I have a no-jerk policy.
No jerk, no drama.
No jerk, no drama policy. you know, that there's just so much happening in the world that every single day I feel like it's really important if you're able to, you know, for the things that you can control, really kind of create an environment where positivity and creativity can exist. And something I've learned over the years from various projects that I've worked on is, you know, as an actor, once you leave that set, any movie can be made. And there's only so much control of the script that you have. And there's only so much, there's really none of in the editing room. And so you can do your best on that day. And then the rest is up to the interpretation of the editor and the director and the producers and the studios involved. And so I think moving forward, something I'm really fascinated by and committed to is producing projects that I'm a part of, and producing projects not just for me but for other people as well. You know, we're so fortunate to do what we do, and it's one of the only art forms that literally takes hundreds of people to create one piece of art. And I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that everyone is important, and everyone's opinion is important, and the collaborative effort is really what makes a good film. And so I'm just inclined to do projects that are seemingly very collaborative and creative.
You have recently worked with another really good actor who is producing her own content, and that's Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah.
So when you're working with somebody like Reese, who is developing material, what do you see in what she's doing that you want to emulate as a producer, or the other people that you want to model yourself after as you're developing material that either might be for you or for somebody else?
You know, the thing with producing is it's so exciting to me, because you're an alchemist or a chemist. You're finding all of these different elements and mixing them all together to create an elixir that hopefully is, you know, has the best of all possibilities. And I think Reese is really, really good at that. I think it's incredible how, you know, we talk often on the set of Big Little Lies, Zoe Kravitz and I, with the other women that we're working with, about how different our generations are. And, you know, Reese and Nicole and Laura Dern, they talk often about how growing up in this industry, there weren't a lot of opportunities for women in the way that there are now. And I can't necessarily relate to that, because most of the projects that I've done have been female-oriented, female-driven, have incredible female producers and strong female elements and characters. And so there's different generations. And I think, you know, I'm inspired by how Reese has taken what she felt disenfranchised, you know, as a growing woman in this industry, and used that as a fuel to her fire for producing. And for me, I'm really, you know, I feel like my fuel is injustice and oppression. And that doesn't mean that those are only the projects that I wish to produce, but it's definitely something that I'm deeply interested in, and that can span from females to gay rights to the environment to the fact that we just don't really take a lot of time to explore human psychology anymore in filmmaking. And so I guess that would be my feel.
Well, Tammy, the character that you play in this movie, said in an interview about what kept her going, she said, "One second at a time, just get through one thing at a time and remain focused and determined and keep going," which is, you know, how you survive at sea, but also how you deal with a lot of problems in the world.
Absolutely. I'll never forget I remember as a young person being so frustrated with, you know, the fact that people didn't take climate change seriously. I still am. And that we're not changing our lifestyles enough to create the difference that I think needs to be made for the planet. And someone said, God, it was probably Alexander Payne, actually. I don't know if it was, but someone really wise when I was young said, "You got to turn the wheel slowly, because if you turn it fast, you're going to crash. If you're on the freeway going 70 miles an hour and you yank that wheel, you're going to spin out. If you slowly and incrementally move through the lanes, you're going to get off the freeway and everything's going to work out great." And I have to think of the world like that. It is one day at a time. It is turning the wheel slowly, as long as you keep turning that wheel.
Shailene, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Adrift is in theaters on May 31st, and you can find season one of Big Little Lies on HBO Go. The Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown Los Angeles has been an acclaimed presence in the global art world since its founding in 1979. But last week, the museum announced that its current leader, Philippe Verne, will depart when his 5-year contract ends next spring. Questions about Verne's future at MoCA had been swirling ever since he fired the museum's highly respected chief curator, Helen Molesworth, in March. Verne's departure adds to a period of instability for the museum, which in 2008 came close to shutting its doors because of financial trouble. The museum was rescued by prominent supporters, including Eli Broad, but that was followed by the controversial appointment of art dealer Jeffrey Deitch as the museum's director. He left in 2013 and was succeeded by Philippe Verne. Los Angeles Times art critic Christopher Knight says this all adds up to more than 20 years of ineffective leadership at MoCA. And when we spoke, I asked him how successful museum directors balance fundraising with the artistic part of the job.
Essentially, everybody needs to be on the same page. Both the director's office and the executive committee of the board need to be on the same page. And the director and the chief curator need to be on the same page because while a director is responsible for bringing the institution towards fulfillment of the museum's mission, it's the chief curator who is generally responsible for shaping the program. And at MoCA, there seem to be two distinct parts of that artistic program, the one that the director was guiding and the one that the chief curator was guiding, and they didn't really mesh.
And that can be as much by kind of personalities clashing as it can be by job definitions. Should MoCA consider splitting the job in two, have a CEO and also someone in charge of the exhibitions program?
I don't know whether that's ever been considered there. It's a division that has been tried elsewhere and has failed miserably elsewhere, which is not to say that institutions don't keep trying to divide it into two jobs. It never seems to work. And there's really no reason for it. If a director knows administration, then the relationship between a director and a chief curator should be comparable to the relationship that is posited for a CEO and a director.
You wrote over the weekend, and I'm quoting you now, Verne was unable to make the transition from curator to director. That means MoCA, a major art museum of international significance, has been without an effective director going on 20 years, half its lifetime, unquote. What has that meant for the museum, its reputation, its collection, and its shows?
The track record that the museum has in terms of building collection and exhibition program has often been stellar. They've done, you know, some really remarkable things, but they can't seem to stay on the track, on the operational track. There's always been a somewhat contentious board, a board that wants to see its own vision manifest in the programming of the institution. And in general terms, that's fine. It's when it gets into the specific realm of which artists will have exhibitions that problems can arise. And I think an example from the not-too-distant past goes a long way to explaining how these tensions can derive. Helen Molesworth wanted to organize a retrospective for the artist Kerry James Marshall, who had come up in Los Angeles, had gone to Otis Art Institute, began to develop his career here, moved on to Chicago, and created a really significant body of work. Sources have told me that when the Kerry James Marshall exhibition appeared on the exhibition budget that was run by the Board of Trustees, a number of people on the board were saying, why are we doing this show? We've never heard of this artist. What seems to be the problem? Why are we doing this? It turned out to be the biggest blockbuster MoCA has had in years and years and years. That should have been an exhibition where there was no conflict at all in putting it on the program. It's perfectly reasonable if a board says, we're not familiar with this artist, why are you doing this? As opposed to, we've never heard of this artist, don't do this, talk us into it. There needs to be a kind of easy rapport between a board and a staff. And when that doesn't happen, then the dissension tends to go both ways.
Let me ask you this last question. How would you define MoCA's role, or at least its potential role, in the city's visual arts landscape? Because it seems telling that hundreds of people queue up every hour, every day, to see the art at the Broad Museum. It's just a couple of hundred yards away. And yet MoCA is about as empty as a theater playing Star Wars most days, that you can just walk right in and there's no queue at all. So what is the missed opportunity and what does the future present in terms of what MoCA might be able to accomplish under strong leadership?
I think the comparison between the two institutions can be somewhat problematic, partially because the Broad is free. MoCA is $15. The Broad is committed to celebrity programming. MoCA is committed to artistic programming. Those are very different things. I think there are ways in which MoCA should have been able to play on the popular success of the Broad. Historically, one of the fundamental differences between MoCA and every other museum in not just Los Angeles, but in the United States, is that it was known as the Artists' Museum. It's a museum that was begun by artists. It's a museum that has five artists on its board of trustees and an artist's voice in the operations of an institution is unusual and should be far more significant than it seems to be at MoCA. I guarantee you that when the Kerry James Marshall retrospective was put on the exhibition program at the museum, every single one of those artists knew exactly who Kerry James Marshall was, and that should have been the end of it.
Christopher Knight is the art critic at the Los Angeles Times. Christopher, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
And that is our show for today. You can keep up with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow.